Greetings and welcome to Catholic Cardinal Reflections, the regular podcast of the Catholic community at Stanford University. This is a weekly podcast of Sunday homilies and theological reflections given by the staff of the Catholic community and their guests. Today's speaker is Father Nathan Castle, OP, pastor and director of the Catholic community. It is the 23rd Sunday in Ordinary Time, and the readings are from Cycle C.
I had 4 weeks all in a row for some vacation, a retreat, and a few more vacation days making my way back down here from Northern California and Southern Oregon. I was with my closest friend, Father Richard. We've been friends 33 years all that while. So there's a lot of golf, lots of reading, sleeping in, eating, retreat. Richard reads more than anybody I know. And even though there aren't a lot of bookstores anymore, if there's one anywhere around, he'll find it. And he especially likes the odd ones that don't belong to a chain, and particularly the ones that are just full of old books, used books, that somebody who loves books rents some little storefront and sells whatever they want to have in their place. I know I've been with him on enough trips that when we go into a bookstore for a minute, be ready to stay. Well, while he's off in the religion and philosophy section, I'm usually in the history section because I like to read history and biography and autobiography. I like to know people. And what did I run into? I made a new friend. Herbert Hoover. Made me think of you. I've been here, this will be my 7th year on campus, and I'm around Hoover Tower all the time and Hoover this and that. I even live in the building that he made the major gift toward. His picture's on the first floor of Old Union. He mentions it in the book, that he made a major gift to Old Union because it was important that the Stanford students have a place to gather. He wrote about his Stanford years. He was here on October the 1st in 1891, the first day Stanford opened. He was a freshman, 17 years old. Here's what he said. Stanford in those days was a small community of intimate association between professors and students. We just soaked up a lot of education. The inspirations of physics, chemistry, geology, mathematics, mechanics, and engineering, all of these came easily to me. Okay. Wouldn't you like to be Herbert Hoover? I was therefore able to carry an unusual amount for engineers of instruction in fuzzy things. He did not say fuzzy things. He says, in a unusual amount of instruction in history, economics, and English, and French literature. As I recollected, I failed in only one course, German. I don't recollect, however, that I ever attained A's in any of my courses. I had too many other yens and occupations and non-curricular activities. He didn't care about grades. He was too busy learning to care if he got an A. We're working on a class in religion and science that's going to be in the curriculum in the spring. Here's what he says. I attended many lectures on biology, evolution, and the reconciliation of science and religion. The impact of the university upon fundamentalist religion of the times brought spiritual conflicts to many youngsters with much debate. He was a Quaker. The Quaker inner light as the basis of faith, however, suffered much less than some others. I much more easily adapted fundamental natural law into my spiritual complex than those whose early training was in more formalistic sects or of wider doctrinal base. I think we would be of wider doctrinal base. I got to know him, and when I read, I believe that everybody survives their death, and I believe Herbert Hoover is alive as everybody else. So when I read, I invite the person I'm reading about to come sit by me. Come be in my imagination. I'd like to get to know you. I learned about him. I knew that he was a president during the Depression and that he only was one term. I remember hearing that he was here on campus the night he got elected. And of course, radio was the mass media of the time, and so all the radio reporters were at his house somewhere up here. Any of you know where he lived? Somewhere up, like, where the president's house is. And all the national media was there here on campus to have him learn about getting elected. He left here and got a job at 21 years old in a silver mine in Nevada as a kind of lowest level employee, even though he was an engineer from Stanford. And he just worked his way up through the mining industry, kept being good at what he was doing. There were a lot of new techniques for mining that were making it a lot less dangerous to miners and a lot more profitable if you were well organized. He started doing that and being so successful that he started being called to all different parts of the world. He was in Australia. He was in China. He opened a mine in Burma. He was all over the place for a number of years. So he began to be this kind of international citizen, and he knew all kind of things about currency exchange and about acculturation, about lots of things, and he was so well-read to begin with. Then, when he was in his 30s, war broke out. And America was late to enter that First World War. But he was put to a job that nobody else seemed up to. He'd never done anything like this before, but he was so knowledgeable. He was tasked with trying to keep an entire nation from starving. I learned that during like 1914, 15, 16, the country of Belgium got overrun by the Germans. And before the war started, Belgium never did produce enough food to feed itself. It had to rely on exchange. It counted on other people's food to be imported so that they could eat. Well, then the railways were all co-opted. The shipping was all messed up. And the Belgians were starving. Had you and I been kids in school in those years in the U.S., we would have been part of Save the Belgian Children funds. He said there were like penny drives and, you know, old clothes and bake sales and stuff like that for Belgian relief. He was put in charge of trying to keep the nation of Belgium from starving. The problem was the Germans were occupying it, and the Allies, the British and the French, were blockading it. So there was no way to get in it unless he could get the warring parties to agree. The Allies didn't want their blockade lessened, and their argument was, if we let you bring this food in, the German military is just going to take it and feed their soldiers. His counter-argument was, if we don't get food in there, women and children are going to starve and die. Well, he got in there and he created a network. He's just a young businessman, and he had to work with the economic system to arrange for price controls in the United States and guarantee every farmer that they would get a certain amount of money for the crops that they'd raise. He found that lots of people who were raising crops were not putting them on the market because they were afraid, they were hoarding and making sure that they could feed their own family. So he had to create an economic model that made it make sense for people to make sure that the food that they produced got available for sale and transport. It was so complicated. Well, he did that for several years and managed to get 3 years' worth of food to the starving population. When we did end up entering the war, things got even worse. But then he goes on to talk about when the war came to an end, what it was like then to try to deal with what should have been a time when you'd think there would be great joy because war is over. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but for a moment I'm going to speak about these the scripture texts. You've got the Book of Wisdom, somebody sitting down. In the Hebrew, wisdom wasn't just about, I don't know, being profound or like a guru or something. Wisdom had to do with practical application of ideas, not just knowing a thing, but figuring out what to do. And isn't it perplexing to know what to do on the international stage right now? What's the right thing to do? I heard the president is making a big speech on Tuesday night talking about his thinking, but the reason he hasn't acted even yet is because he's kind of following the British example of going into Parliament and talking the whole thing through. In this democracy of ours, I can't remember a moment quite like it where we're being dared to speak up and express to our representatives what we think ought to be done. The person that's writing the letter to the Book of Wisdom is saying, but how do we even know how to think? I'm not a political preacher that tells people what they ought to do and how they ought to vote, but I can at least maybe frame a question or two. I don't think we get to even know our own heart or the mind of God without prayer, without sitting still, and then acting somehow, even without full certainty. I so admire Paul in the second reading, where there was, in the first century, there was just no way in the world that he was going to see the end of slavery. It seemed like that Adam and Eve were the first slaveholders, that it had just been around forever, and it was just something that everybody had to accept. Slavery is just the way things are. And yet you heard that reading. He ends up loving a man who's a slave and speaking to his master and saying, you should love him too. And by the way, you ought to set him free. What kind of nerve did that take? What kind of imagination to be able to say, this is the way things ought to be. Do that because it's right. Then, for crying out loud, you have Jesus coming into the mix. There's a crowd following him, and you would think he'd be thrilled about that. You know, his stock's going up and the crowds are getting bigger. And then he turns around and says to you, you want to follow me? Okay. Then hate your family. And if you cannot hate father and mother and sister and brother, you cannot be my disciple. What in the world do you do with that? Well, part of the background was that in the first century world, and I think it's still large parts of our world, it's okay to treat your clan, your tribe, your gangbangers, your people, whoever they are, as your own, and you can love them as long as you're willing to hate the other one, as long as you're willing to oppose the opponent. I think that's what Jesus was addressing. He said, if that's what you're about, you're not about what I'm about. In fact, the word Xavier mentioned to me, the Greek word, you cannot, means you don't have the power to. It's not about permission. It's not Jesus saying, I won't let you follow me. Jesus is saying, you won't have the power in you. The word is dunamis in the Greek. It's the word from which we get dynamite. The power to blow up a mountain. You won't have the power in you to follow me if you're not willing to hate any system that tells you it's okay to love this one but hate that one. The whole system needs to change. That's what Jesus is saying. If you want to follow me, you need to calculate the cost. Think of the guy that's going to build a tower or a king that's going to go into a battle undermanned. They would strategize and they would think and they would make wise decisions. Do that if you're going to follow me, because it could cost you. When the war ended, and it should have been a great time, 1918, end of the war, Herbert Hoover's job wasn't over. In fact, it was really larger than ever, because now even the Germans couldn't feed themselves. They were vanquished, and so were the Austrians and the Hungarians and the Turks. So now there was these great big European countries that had just lost a war, and they were starving. And the only ones that now controlled who got food were the ones who won. And guess who was in the midst of the treaty making to end that war? Stanford graduate, Herbert Hoover. He's there, and President Wilson is still back over here, but Hoover is there on the front lines trying to figure out how this peace ought to come about. Then President Wilson comes over, and Hoover advises him on the first day that he gets there. It's December 15, 1918. On the day that the president arrived, we had a discussion about my immediate problems. He asked me what I thought about the whole situation in Paris. I remarked that the whole air had suddenly become charged with currents of indescribable malignancy. There had been a letdown in that whole esprit de corps that accompanies war, all of Europe was now faced with desperation. I said if they were persons, I could describe their attitudes as being dominated by greed, power, hatred, and revenge. But I could think of no equivalent expression applicable to entire nations. In any event, I told the president that he would meet with fevered nationalism, imperialism, militarism, balances of power, reactions, and determination to be the one that gets there first. I told him that certainly the bonds of private personal integrity, generosity, or sportsmanship would not count in the least in the forthcoming battle of national ambition and national fear. This is people trying to make a peace treaty. I said that these things were not attitudes towards the enemies alone, that he should expect that there would be embraces of advantage over one's own partners and allies. I told him that deference to American views and wishes was already pretty weak. I was convinced that America was accepted in Europe as the golden-egged goose. As such, our life would be safe, but not our eggs. He was shocked and expressed a disagreement that such terms should be used in respect to allies of ours who had just led these glorious triumphs of democracy. About 2 months later, he recalled that conversation and remarked, "Now I know what you meant." He wrote this in 1951. He's an old man. He's a former president. But he's looking back at an earlier part of his life at the peace treaty that was supposed to conclude the war that ended all wars. But instead, people just used it as an occasion to hate and to grab and set the stage for all the nastiness that went on in the 20s and into the 30s. I bring this up because I've heard argumentation that says that if we don't do missile strikes in Syria, it'll be just like 1938. It'll be appeasement. And if you appease a dictator, what you get is a Holocaust. Well, maybe. I don't know. But Hoover writes at near the end of his life, or in the last decade of his life, and says, no, that was not what caused the Second War. What caused the Second War was the hatred at the end of the first one, and the way that everybody looked out for themselves rather than trying to look out for one another. It was just too much to hope that people could love an enemy. Well, he ended up trying to keep now the entire continent of Europe from starving, and that became his work for like 3 or 4 years afterwards, and he did all that work, and then was more than happy to get on a ship and put an ocean between him and the whole bunch. I love the guy. I want to read the next part of his memoirs when I can find that in some odd bookstore. Maybe I'll go over to Hoover Tower. They probably got it. Where do we go with all this? I just don't know, because I'm like the person in the Book of Wisdom. How do you begin to know the mind of God? But I can't imagine the mind of God wants more violence on top of all the violence that's already, that the world has already known. Pay attention these next few days, and if you didn't have an opportunity for prayer and fasting, maybe take that opportunity on your own. We're certainly not called to be a kind of people that just says, I will love this group, I will love my clan, I will love my tribe, I will love my homies, I will love my nation, but I don't care about those other ones. That's already been tried. It hasn't worked very well. Finally, remember the one that we follow who said, you don't have to follow me if you don't want to, but if you do, I need you to do it on my terms. Do you remember what happened when we finally broke with him and said, I never even knew the man? Do you remember when our leader said, I never even heard of him? And then we all ran and hid at the violent time. And then we ended up locked in a room praying, not knowing what to do. And do you remember he walked right through the wall? Remember that story? What was the first thing he said to you? You'll get yours. What did he say? You don't have to say it in a whisper. Peace be with you. Peace be with you. Peace be with you. Somehow I think if we follow him, That has to be the sentiment of our heart, and it has to be the way that we try to look at a situation that just seems so global and so large and act in whatever way we can to be consistent with that voice that says, peace be with you.
This has been a presentation of Catholic Cardinal Reflections, the regular podcast of the Catholic community at Stanford University. Director, Gary Glover. With music by Albert Tommaso and Shane Clarkson. For more information, please visit our website at catholic.stanford.edu or visit our offices on the third floor of Old Union. Till next time, God bless you.